This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. When it comes to Twitter, you've got your run-of-the-mill online interactions, tweets and hashtags. There's even passive-aggressive subtweeting. Some topics are trending. But what conditions are necessary to bring on a full-fledged Twitter storm? When it comes to discussing the field of science, it seems Twitter may be amplifying a big problem, sexism. And while it may be easy for some to dismiss these seemingly fleeting engagements, these conversations are bringing to light discrimination and harassment that consistently dog the field of science. Joining me now to discuss the nexus of science and sexism on Twitter and other select short subjects in science is Virginia Hughes. She's science editor at BuzzFeed News in New York, and she joins me in studio. Welcome back to the program, Virginia.
Thank you very much, John. Good to be here.
So what are some instances of sexism in science that have gotten a lot of attention on Twitter?
Yeah, so this all came from a fascinating story in Nature this week. I'll just rattle off a few things you probably remember. Late last year, when the European Space Agency landed that spacecraft on a comet, one of the project's leaders ended up wearing this shirt with scantily clad women all over it.
And not then, a great look.
Yeah, doing a ton of interviews. So that led to hashtag shirtstorm and several other hashtags, I think. So that was one of the first ones recently. Then there was a woman, her name was Fiona Ingleby, who tweeted about a sexist peer review that one of her papers received at PLOS. Then there was the Tim Hunt saga, the Nobel Prize winner who ended up making some sexist remarks at a conference, and those remarks were first reported on Twitter. And then most recently, about a month ago, after BuzzFeed broke the story about astronomer Jeff Marcy's sexual harassment, it promoted this huge discussion among astronomers on Twitter. So these Twitter storms, as the Nature article gets into a little bit, they have this pro and con where it's a really great way maybe to draw awareness and get things done. For instance, the woman who tweeted about her paper's peer review ended up getting an apology from the journal and she got a new review. Tim Hunt stepped down from a few positions. So these things can lead to change. But they can also lead to some really nasty reactions, death threats, rape threats. Twitter can be this, like, stew of hate sometimes.
Yeah, Twitter can have its good and its bad side. Let's turn to a 200-year-old form of alternative medicine, homeopathy, and it's facing some new scrutiny now.
Yes. So this week, the FDA closed a public comment period, which is kind of It's one of these FDA terms that doesn't really mean much, but basically the FDA is finally looking into homeopathy remedies, which have been pretty much unregulated so far. In case you don't know what it is, it's a huge business, $6.4 billion. And these remedies, the basic idea is that if you take the thing that makes you sick and you dilute it by huge factors of many, many thousands of times, then that will cure you. It doesn't have any basis in scientific reality, but it's very, very popular. And it has this fascinating history. It debuted 200 years ago, as you said, in Germany. And I'll just give one very weird popular example where after the Spanish flu, a French physician claimed that this imaginary germ was responsible for the flu and that this germ just happened to grow on duck livers. So he took duck liver, diluted it, you know, many, many, many times over and started selling it as something called oscillococcium flu treatment, which, is nonsense, but in my opinion.
Well, in your opinion, but yeah. I mean, are these things just harmless placebos or can they hurt you?
So the vast majority are probably harmless placebos. They're sugar pills, most of them. However, there are these examples of seeming harm. In 2009, the FDA received more than 130 accounts of people who lost their sense of smell after taking a Zicam homeopathic remedy, which is a nasal spray. There was another one, teething tablets that were marketed as 100% natural that actually apparently led to some seizures and slowed breathing in kids. So I think these safety things are pretty rare. Most of the time, these things are not going to hurt you, but you never know.
Let's turn to another story. Almost 10 years after faking data for a number of cancer studies, a scientist is just now being reprimanded by the federal government. Tell us about the scientist and why this took so long.
Yeah, it took forever. So this guy's name is Anil Poti, And he used to be a cancer researcher at Duke University. And he's been known for years as one of the most notorious fraudsters in science. But just this Monday, the federal government's Office of Research Integrity sort of officially deemed him a fraud. So he faked data officially now in 9 papers that were related to 6 federal grants. And his research was really, you could see why it got into all these big studies. So he claimed to have found genetic signatures that could predict which cancer patients would respond to particular chemotherapies. And he did all this stuff in the lab, and then he also launched human clinical trials based on this, turned out to be fraudulent idea. So the craziest thing to me is, as of 2012, Retraction Watch, the blog that often reports on misconduct, reported that he was still a practicing oncologist in North Dakota. And this week, the Washington Post confirmed that he was still apparently there. He's still on the voice answering machine at this place. So, yeah, I think the bottom line is, like, the federal process for formally sanctioning fraud is really slow, like, ridiculously slow.
All right, we're going to turn to one last story here. You bring us one about a bunch of freezers in a Harvard basement that are chock full of something kind of gross. Toenail clippings? What can we learn from toenail clippings?
Yeah, this is such a fun story. It came from a brand new publication about science and health news called STAT. And yeah, it's about these Harvard freezers full of toenails. And it's part of a project called the Nurses Health Study, which has been collecting health data and samples from nurses for several decades. So they have 3.5 million samples of blood and urine, and then, as you say, 100,000 samples of toenails. So why toenails? When you look at a blood sample, that is, you know, representing a biological signature at a given moment in time. You know, your blood can change after you eat or exercise or whatever. But toenails can apparently, they contain traces of chemical exposures like arsenic or mercury that can give information about sort of a month-to-month timescale of your body. And the weirdest thing is that your toenails grow at different speeds. So apparently a clipping from your little toe could get a snapshot of your exposures for about a month, whereas your big toe might give a snapshot of about a year's worth of exposures.
So to really get anything, you got to have a lot of toenails.
You got to clip and clip.
Oh, okay. Well, that leaves me feeling a little funny. We've run out of time. I want to thank Virginia Hughes, science editor at BuzzFeed News in New York. Thanks so much, Virginia.
No problem.
Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side, imagine showing up to math class. You're in your seat surrounded by classmates, some of whom have already mastered the material, others who continue to struggle. Class starts, but instead of your teacher going to the front of the classroom and writing out equations, you start working by yourself on a computer program called Alex. This adaptive software gives you problems tailor-made to your comprehension level, and it sounds like it could be pretty great, but it's not quite that simple. Joining me now to talk about this adaptive software, increasingly pushed by textbook companies as they look to reinvent themselves, is Will Oremus. He's senior technology writer at Slate in New York. He joins me in studio. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Thanks for having me.
So what are some of the good things about introducing artificially intelligent software into the classroom?
Well, the good thing is we may have finally found a way to improve on a 500-year-old technology, which is the printed textbook. I'm not just talking about e-books. This is software that uses machine learning algorithms and other sorts of algorithms to actually try to learn the strengths and weaknesses of each student as they work through the material. And in some cases, the way this is being implemented in classrooms is actually changing the whole classroom experience. So in the old model, you have a teacher who stands up and lectures to, let's say, 20 students at once. They go home at night and they all work on the same pages of the same textbook, do the same practice problems. Now, they came in probably at very different skill levels. Some of them are going to be ahead. They're going to be bored by the material. Others are going to be falling behind, but the class won't slow down for them, so they might just get lost and tune out. They might decide they're bad at math. A lot of people think they're really bad at math. Maybe it's the system that's failing them. So in the implementation that I saw at a community college in Valhalla, New York, the students came into the class and sat down at the computers, as you described. They all worked through the same material, but at a different pace. So the software would guide them through the material. It wouldn't move them on to the next subject until they'd mastered one. They could set their own course to some extent. There's some flexibility involved there. The advantage is they're eventually all going to learn the same stuff. They're just going to learn it at different rates. So the students who are falling behind don't necessarily fail. They just may take longer than a semester to pass the class. students who are ahead could pass the class halfway through the semester, go ahead and pass another class in the same semester.
So that all sounds really great. I mean, what could be the downside of that?
Yeah, it does sound great, especially when you listen to the textbook companies that have invested
I'm sure.
that have invested their future on this type of technology. It's actually a lot more profitable for them potentially, because whereas you can borrow a friend's textbook or Xerox some pages or buy it used, the technology can require a digital license for every single student every year. So that's a good thing for the textbook companies. What could be the bad thing? Well, you know, you have to think a little bit harder about what the real goal of education is. So when you're individualizing the material for each student, it's nice because each student is able to go at their own pace. But you also lose that thing where students are working on the same thing at the same time, and they can help each other out. They can, you know, one of them gets stuck and the other one has to learn the skill of how do you teach a peer to get over a hump in a problem. You know, they have to learn patience working with each other. And those kinds of softer skills maybe don't get picked up as easily in a class where the computer is designed to give you exactly the material you're ready for, exactly when you're ready for it. And the other issue is that there are softer skills involved in the math reasoning itself. So there's a famous problem that was posed in a 1986 research paper. It's called "How Old is the Shepherd?" So bear with me for a second here. A bunch of grade school students were asked, there are 125 sheep and 5 dogs in a shepherd's field. How old is the shepherd? The majority of them gave some kind of numerical answer. They'd say, oh, well, 125 divided by 5, the shepherd's 25.
Yeah.
And it's because they've been trained to apply formulas by rote to problems rather than stepping back, asking, what is this all about? Why am I being asked this?
Well, some good things and some bad things there. Thanks for bringing us the story, Will. Will Oremus is senior technology writer at Slate in New York. He joined us here in studio. Thanks again, Will.
Thanks.
Now, after the break, we're going to take a look at the trade in trafficking endangered and threatened plants. That's coming up next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. When you're flying back from a trip overseas, one of the last things you do before landing is fill out those little blue customs forms. And one of the things you have to declare is any plants, seeds, fruits, or vegetables. And most of us don't check that box. But each year, the Fish and Wildlife Service seizes thousands of undocumented plants. Some might just be missing the proper paperwork, but others are illegally smuggled, secretly slipped into the bottom of suitcases, or checked in under false names. They're confiscated under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES. A few of these errant plants find their way into CITES rescue centers across the country. One of these centers is located behind closed doors at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. SciFri producers Alexa Lim and Becky Fogel got a tour from Mark Hachidorian, the director of the Nolan Greenhouses for Living Collections at the garden.
Well, right now we're in the behind-the-scenes production facility in which we grow all of the plants for the gardens and grounds and exhibitions. Some of the CITES Rescue Center program plants are in this location here. Including most recently, a couple of years ago, a group of plants that were being shipped illegally from Vietnam. And this group of slip orchids arrived sort of crammed in a box, near death, not looking too good when you first see them. They're now growing and thriving and even flowering within our glasshouse collections. Shipments can range in size from a single plant to our largest CITES shipment, which was over 1,500 plants. If you were actually to see the plants when they first arrived, as we unpacked these plants, it just seemed endless that you took out more and there was an even another layer and another layer and another layer. The plants themselves were bare root, really stuffed and tortured. And there was even one specimen of a plant called Grammatophyllum speciosum, which is one of the world's largest orchids, that you can actually see in the root ball in the center, this large, tight, dense mass of roots where it was cut and then peeled off the tree it was growing on. We've now walked into a different section of the greenhouse. This is our arid collections, where we grow all of our cacti and succulent specimens. Very different, as you might imagine, from the orchid house. It's much drier and brighter in here. What looks like a scaly bowling ball with leaves or a pineapple that you probably wouldn't want to eat here is actually a cycad. Cycads are a group of prehistoric plants that have been around since, you know, the time of the dinosaurs, and they're very popular with collectors. And this is a group of cycads that were being smuggled in from South Africa. And what's sometimes torturous about cycads is that many times when they come in, they don't have a single leaf on them, and it's just this large woody stem. They can sit for almost 2 years before they put out any new leaves, so you don't really know if it's alive or dead for quite a while. They arrive with no identification, but now that they've started to leaf out, we'll be able to identify them down to the species they are. And the species that we theorize that they might be are species that are very, very rare in the wild and are very threatened due to over-collecting. You know, I realize that a lot of the plants are coming here really are better off in the wild. I mean, when you have, you know, 7,000 plants to take care of and a few more mouths to feed, so to speak, it really is a lot of work to make sure we keep these plants going, because there is a lot of responsibility. Just as there would be responsibility taking care of an endangered animal, the same thing goes with an endangered plant.
That was Mark Hachadorian, the director of the Nolan Greenhouses for Living Collections, showing our Sci-Fi producers around the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. You can see photos of those plants on our website at sciencefriday.com/plantpoaching. Overseas orchid hunters scouring the cliffs of Vietnam might be the scene that comes to mind when you think of plant poaching, but the illegal plant trade happens right here in the U.S. too, in the bogs of the Carolinas to the palm forests of Hawaii. This January, North Carolina passed a law that made it a felony to poach wild Venus flytraps. My next guest is here to tell us about that. Johnny Randall is the Director of Conservation Programs at the North Carolina Botanical Garden in Chapel Hill. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here.
And if you've come across an endangered plant for sale, or you've got a plant in your collection that you're just not sure about, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us at SciFry. So, Johnny Randall, store-bought Venus flytraps are often the first plant you get as a kid. Can you describe where these wild types grow that are maybe a little different?
Well, the plants are essentially the same, but, of course, the wild types are ones that grow in specialized habitats and a very limited distribution here in North Carolina.
Limited distribution? How limited?
Well, the Venus flytraps range is about 90 miles circumference of Wilmington, North Carolina, on the coast.
Okay, so tell us about people who poach these wild Venus flytraps. What do they do, just dig them out of the ground?
Yep, they just dig them right out. You can dig out probably many hundreds in an hour. But the folks who are poaching these from the wild are just trying to make a few extra dollars. The poached Venus flytraps might go for 25 cents a piece, but it's really the dealers that are driving this and getting these folks to make these harvests.
That's one of the things about this story that's fascinated me. It's that these plants, which are endangered, are going for 25 or 50 cents a piece. I mean, you'd think that maybe they'd have a much higher price tag. Why are people going to all this trouble to dig up something that's endangered and also getting them so little money?
Well, you know, we're talking about people who are probably having hard times, the locals down on the coast of North Carolina. So they may dig up a plant for 25 cents and sell it for that, but then the dealer's turning around and selling it for $10.
Why exactly would someone want a wild Venus flytrap? I mean, how different are they, if at all, from the ones that you can buy legally in the store?
They're absolutely no different. So I think the thing that encourages the dealers to get folks to dig them up is the fact that they are slow to germinate and grow, so it may take 2 or 3 years to get a plant up to for sale if you're growing it from seed. But most of them are grown through either root cuttings or tissue culture, which also is slow, but a perfectly legitimate and process.
Now, it's just been a year or so since the law passed in North Carolina. Are you seeing any impact on this poaching? Do you think that the law is actually going to stop anybody?
Well, it's hard to tell. Only one group of people have been charged so far. It was this past January, and I'm not certain what the outcome of their trial was, if they were actually convicted of this felony or not.
Are there other plants you're seeing that are finding their way into the trade, other plants that people are poaching other than these Venus flytraps?
Well, carnivorous plants in general have been poached for decades. So North Carolina, the coast of North Carolina, is a global hotspot for carnivorous plant diversity, particularly with the Venus flytrap. But the ones that are most often poached are the pitcher plants. And many of those are very rare and endangered and are becoming even more so. And in our mountains is ginseng harvest, which is, again, something that is permitted, but many people go out and do illegal harvests or poaching.
We're talking with Johnny Randall about illegal plant poaching. If you want to call us, 844-724-8255 or 844-SCI-TALK. Michelle is calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello there, Michelle. You're on Science Friday.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I am afraid that I might have accidentally actually poached some of these Venus flytraps off. They were attached to moss that I took from the side of our lake and brought inside in a little dish this spring just to put on the table for my mom to see. And I'm thinking I might be in trouble, but they were Venus flytraps. They looked like little carnivorous Venus flytraps that were in the moss.
And this is in Michigan?
This is in Michigan, yes, in the Upper Peninsula.
Johnny Randall, what do you say to Michelle?
I think that they could occur that far north, but someone had to have planted it there. You might want to take another look at that.
Oh, so perhaps these are Venus flytraps that found their way up to Michigan through some other means. Somebody planted them in the forest first?
That's right. And that's it's probably unlikely, but actually Venus flytrap has been successfully transplanted to the New Jersey Pine Barrens, and it is growing there, but that would not be considered a wild population.
Well, and for Michelle and anybody else who might call us up, John, I mean, what should someone do if they maybe find a plant that they're not sure maybe should even be in their area, or maybe they suspect might be suspicious? I mean, is there someplace they can turn?
Oh, absolutely. Your friendly neighborhood botanical garden. So that's where I would recommend.
Michelle, thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
I hope that helps. The internet, of course, has opened up plant poaching to a much wider audience. I want to bring on another guest who's looked into this. Patrick Shirey is an ecologist and project manager at R.A. Smith National in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Patrick, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, John. As a fellow Pittsburgher, happy to join you today.
Always good to hear from the Steel City. You put out a study a few years ago that looked at eBay as a marketplace for endangered plants. What did you find?
Yeah, not just eBay, but the internet in general. And what we did was we asked how many U.S.-listed plants can be purchased online. So these are threatened and endangered plants listed under the U.S. and Endangered Species Act. And at the time, we found there were over 50 sellers offering 44 plant species illegally, with 49 species total. And even since that study, we found additional plant species being offered, not just on online auction websites, but through nursery websites and other online means.
So I'm a little unclear. Is it illegal to sell them online or not?
It is in some cases, and it isn't in others. So it's illegal if you sell it online between one state and another. So the buyer's in one state and the seller's in a different state. If the seller doesn't have a permit, and a permit costs $100 to get and lasts five years, in some cases, many cases, there weren't permits acquired for these endangered plant species being offered for sale online.
So obviously a lot of sites that are out there, was it pretty easy to buy these type of plants?
It would be very easy to buy certain species of plants, including several cacti and carnivorous plants and other rare plants like the palms in Hawaii that you mentioned at the start of the show.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about those and maybe some of the other plants that you found that surprised you that were for sale.
Well, in Hawaii, there's been some encouragement of planting native plants, but these have also ended up in the international and interstate commercial trade. One of these plants, the Lo'ulu palm, which is a Prichardia viscosa, there are only four left in the wild, and there's been noted poaching and vandalism of the wild population over the years. And this is one plant that the starting auction price for this was $350 for these individual plants.
Yeah, so that brings a pretty nice price tag. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. There are, of course, cultivated versions of endangered plants, Patrick, that are fine to buy. I mean, how do you know if sellers who are doing this online are buying wild or cultivated plants?
We don't know, and that is one of the challenges for enforcement, John. Another example, like the Venus flytrap, is the star cactus in southern Texas, northern Mexico, near the mouth of the Rio Grande. And the star cactus has been available in cultivation since the 1930s. But it also overlaps with the peyote, and it's still threatened with collection of wild populations. Even though tens of thousands of plants are available in commercial trade, the few thousand left in the wild are threatened with poaching.
It seems as though if the government really wanted to crack down on this, I mean, the internet's a really good place to start. Why isn't there more enforcement action happening, Patrick, around this?
I think one of the big challenges is we've lost so much funding for dealing with these issues, both on the supply side and on the demand side. So both in the top-down regulation and the Fish and Wildlife Service working with nurseries to make sure they're following the law, but also the bottom-up side, that we don't have enough market research on consumer demand. There was a study published last month on consumer preferences for orchids in international trade, and we're just starting to get a handle on what hobbyists prefer or collectors prefer when they look for an endangered plant online.
Let's go back to the phones. Tom is calling from Boston. Hi there, Tom.
Hi. The caller who talked about poaching Venus flytraps in the Upper Peninsula, let me put her mind at ease. They were probably sundew. I went to a forestry school in the Adirondacks and did a little interpretive presentation on carnivorous plants, and the climate's probably similar. The sundew and pitcher plant lived that far north.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you, and thank you for putting Michelle's mind at ease, Tom.
Yeah, okay, no problem. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Hey, Patrick, and I asked Johnny Randall about this. Do people turn to you often and ask these questions like, oh my goodness, I think I have a plant that might be illegal. What do I do?
Well, one of the things that ended up after the study is I was contacted by growers, and one of the solutions that the growers and conservation biologists like Johnny have come up with is, why don't we have a certification program instead of a permit program, where like has been done with certifying sustainably grown forest material, timber. Why can't we do that for endangered plant species, where nurseries are vetted and follow proper procedure when propagating plants, so that we keep concerns like genetics and wild populations in mind when reproducing these species for human consumption.
John, does that sound right to you?
Yes, and in fact, in North Carolina, a new ordinance has been enacted where all endangered plants, rare plants that are legal to collect, if you have a permit, must also come with a certificate of origin that indicates exactly where you got this plant, whether you have landowner permission or not. So we are stepping up the regulations a bit.
We're talking about the illegal trade in rare plants, and if you have questions for our guests, 844-724-8255 or 844-SCI-TALK. After the break, we're going to talk more about this issue. Coming up next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankowski, and we're talking this hour about plant poaching. My guests are Johnny Randall, Director of Conservation Programs at the North Carolina Botanical Garden in Chapel Hill, and Patrick Shirey is an ecologist and project manager at R.A. Smith National in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I want to get to a few phone calls. Amanda is calling from San Francisco. Hi there, Amanda. You're on Science Friday. Oh, I think I have Jeff on the line. Excuse me. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, with respect to the laws in North Carolina and elsewhere, both how they're written and enforced, is there some really good provision for providing amnesty, protection, and encouragement for the low-level collectors to turn in the dealers who facilitate and encourage this whole thing and make the money out of it?
Jeff, it's a great question. Johnny Randall?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm sure that law enforcement officials look to that kind of solution.
Yeah, and I wonder, Patrick Shirey, if you have any thoughts about that, because without some sort of enforcement mechanism, it seems as though this is a pretty unfettered marketplace for illegal plants.
Yeah, and talking with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the past, I know they've been overtaxed, and just with the trade in endangered animals and their and parts of endangered animals, they don't have as much money and resources, human resources, to put toward enforcement with endangered plants. So they appreciate if you provide them a tip anonymously, but there's no reward structure or anything like that that I'm aware of.
Johnny, when we were listening to Mark Hachadorian from the Bronx earlier, he clearly loves his plants very, very much and was referring them to them almost like you would hear someone talk about animals that were being rehabilitated. I guess I'm wondering how you feel plant poaching is being treated differently from animal poaching in this country.
Well, I think that it's, plants don't have the ability to run away, so they're particularly vulnerable. As a fellow botanist, I have a great affiliation for plants, so I too care greatly about them. But also, we've seen this, it's just this insidious process of seeing plant populations dwindle in size down to some low level of population viability where there are not enough numbers for them to reproduce effectively and have enough genetic diversity to respond to environmental change, et cetera.
Well, Patrick, one of the things that has been tried in the animal kingdom is this idea that, say, if we flood the trade with fake rhino horns, maybe they'll be less desirable. The demand will go down. Do you think something like this would work with plants?
Yeah, it's been proposed, and in some instances it may work. In others, by increasing the desire, like we've seen with the Venus flytrap, you still have pressure on the wild populations. We do have one example within the last two decades that was successful, and that was the Willamy pine, a conifer that was discovered in Australia in 1994. And what they did with the Willamy pine is they only found 100, 200 individuals of this tree in the wild, and we had a fossil record of this tree dating back tens of millions of years, but we didn't know that it was still in existence. And so conservation biologists in Australia decided to propagate it in the lab, observe it for pests and pathogens and characteristics of being invasive, and it took a process of a decade until they had plants that were ready to introduce into commercial cultivation. And what Australia has done is developed a program where royalties from the sales of the Willamy pine go toward protecting the plants in the wild. And I think for some endangered plants, this is a framework that can be used here in the United States and elsewhere to tackle some of the problems. But I just want to underscore, it was a pretty extensive effort.
Let me try Amanda again, who called in from San Francisco. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a member of the Mycological Society here in San Francisco, and I was wondering how this relates to mushrooms. I know there's a lot of commercial harvesting in the Pacific Northwest, as well as in other areas of the country, and certain mushroom species that are endangered. Does this apply to them as well, or what can you tell me about that?
What do you say, Patrick?
Wow, boy, I have not investigated the mushroom trade, but I would imagine it's even more underground than the endangered plant trade, and I would think that there's even fewer resources spent on studying the challenges with collecting mushrooms.
Johnny, any thoughts on mushrooms?
Well, of course, like Patrick was alluding to, there's a lot underground with the mushroom, so what you're seeing, this fruiting body, is just essentially a fruit, and the main body of the plant is is under the ground as a mycelium, so it's not quite the same as a flowering plant.
I hope that helps answer your question, Amanda. I want to get to Rachel in Chicago. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I'm curious about the importance of wild populations. I think earlier you mentioned that there are plenty of varieties of cultivated Venus flytraps around, and even that there wasn't a lot of difference between them and the wild plants. And so with that, what's the sort of importance of having the wild population still preserved?
That's a great question. Who wants to take that?
I'm happy to. I may have indicated there wasn't any difference in terms of the species, but in cultivated populations that are available commercially, they're pretty much uniform genetically. Many of them are simply clones, whereas in the wild populations, there is genetic variation, as I was talking earlier, where there needs to be this genetic variation in order for plants and all organisms to respond to environmental change. So the wild populations are very important. And also, by removing rare plants or any plant from the wild, you are altering that particular ecosystem and plant community, the plant-plant and plant-animal interactions that we do not fully understand.
Patrick, what do you say?
Yeah, once you remove a plant from the wild, it's dead to that wild population. It can no longer contribute genetics to the wild population, and that is an important concern and something that conservation biologists have discussed.
So there's this new law, or relatively new law, in North Carolina. Obviously, as you've suggested, Patrick, there is some enforcement, but probably not enough. What do we do about this? Is this about vigilance within the community of plant collectors? Does this have something to do with more enforcement? You already said there's probably not enough money for it. I mean, what do we do about this problem?
I think we have to partner with nurseries. I think the commercial growers have said that and desired to be part of the solution, like I said, through a certification program. But we really need education and outreach toward consumers of rare plants. And botanic gardens are doing this. The Mercer Arboretum Botanical Garden in Texas has a program where you can sponsor an endangered plant, and you can volunteer for these botanical gardens. So if you really care about the species, instead of collecting them, why not donate your time to help with the wild populations, help study what's out there?
If you don't have a local botanical garden real near you, though, where do you turn? Is there some place to really learn about all this world?
Yeah, the Center for Plant Conservation is a great start, and Johnny can, I think, talk more about their role in consumer education.
Yeah, the Center for Plant Conservation is a consortium of botanical gardens around the country. There are about 45 gardens that participate, and they hold what is called the National Collection of Endangered Plants and curate, I think, about thousands of plants, where they're held off-site as ex situ conservation collections, usually as seed collections. But at any rate, Center for Plant Conservation has a lot of great information on the recovery of endangered plants in general.
Patrick, we just have a less than a minute left, but do you see that in the course of your career that we start to cut down on illegal plant poaching here in the United States?
Yeah, I think we will. I think there's been desire on both sides of the issue to come to an agreement and to solve this problem, and I think we will. I think there are good reasons for the regulation in the first place. There were some that wanted to ban trade outright, and there were others that didn't want to have any regulation. And the regulations that the Fish and Wildlife Service passed in 1977 were a compromise, and that's what we're all about as a democracy.
Patrick Shirey is an ecologist and project manager at R.A. Smith National in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thanks also to Johnny Randall, Director of Conservation Programs at the North Carolina Botanical Garden in Chapel Hill. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
That sound means it's time to talk about our new Macroscope video. It's up now at sciencefriday.com. Video producer Luke Groskin joins me in studio to talk about it. Welcome back, Luke.
Hi, John.
So the Macroscope video this week looks at ants, slime molds, and the New Jersey Turnpike. What's the connection?
So besides the fact that you don't want any of those near your home, they're the field of research for Dr. Simon Gagné of the New Jersey Institute of Technology, who runs a swarm lab. And what he's interested in looking at is at communal behaviors, at group decision-making. How do, you know, ants or unicellular organisms, how do they decide to do things? What's the mechanisms? What's the systems? And also, how do we as people do the same? How do we decide to work together, and how does our systems work together?
Okay, so let's take ants first. You look at ants on the ground. They seem to just be roaming around randomly, but they are very organized.
Sure, yes, they are. And the question is how, and because there's no leader. There's no the queen's not sending out orders. Oh, go over there, go get those mealworms and bring them back. So all decisions are made communally, and they're done through kind of a system of communication for most species with pheromones. And Dr. Simon Gagné, he researches one species called the army ant. And the army ant is very nomadic. They wander around the forest. They don't set up and build colonies underneath ground. And that means they have to be extremely efficient at foraging. And what that means is that they have to work together to make the most efficient pathways. Now, Dr. Gagné and his colleagues have done experiments with them where they set up gaps, where the ants have to kind of find a way to get to bridge a gap. And if you watch the video, you'll see this incredible time-lapse footage where you see these ants build a bridge or a ladder to cross a gap. It's really fantastic behavior. And what they found was they think that these ants, when one ant is being stepped on, that's the cue for them to just stop. So there's a programming inside the ant to just stop. And you'd repeat that over and over and over again, and eventually you get a bridge that crosses a span. And what's really cool is not only can you build a bridge, the bridge can move. So the bridge, it'd be like the George Washington Bridge. You know, more people want to go downtown that day, and the George Washington Bridge angles itself more downtown to create a shorter path. The ants do this. Now, there's no leader. There's no decision. Nobody says it's time to do this, but they do it anyway.
And you have to see this video because this is the coolest thing, these ants making a bridge. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And so, Luke, so now ants, we know what ants look like, but we never think about slime mold. Tell us how slime mold fits into all this.
Okay, so slime mold, imagine John Dankowski. Now we take all the walls of his cells and we remove all the cell walls. So now he's just a blob of John Dankowski. Now we take out his brain, and then you tint him yellow, and that's kind of what slime mold is. It lives on the forest floor, and it loves moisture and darkness, and it just meanders around looking for food. Now it has no eyes. And it can only feel for food. So how does that make a decision? How does that creature decide, oh, it's time to go over here, it's time to go over there? So what they saw, what they realized is that the slime mold will pulsate. It's really, really gross. It just kind of grows in specific areas and just kind of it pulsates. That's the best way to describe it. And the more rapid the pulsation is at a specific spot, the more fluid and resources get pumped to that spot. Now, they've done experiments at this lab where in New Jersey where they watch the slime mold. They put more food on one side of a track, and then they put less food on the other. And 80% of the time, the slime mold goes to the side that has more food.
Hold it. If we flip a coin, we make a decision. It's like 50-50, right? But the slime mold's right 85% of the time?
Yes. It's absolutely way, way better than anything we could do. And you can apply the same sort of concept to economics or buying a new computer. You don't know what the best model is out there. You only have a set amount of information. So which one are you going to go with? The slime mold has no eyes. It has no sensory equipment besides its touching food. But yet it makes the decision right 80% of the time.
And one of the things we hope to learn out of all this is not just how to maybe go to the casino and bet or maybe play the stock market, but also how to get around and how to, I don't know, get off the New Jersey Turnpike.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, you want to find the quickest route out of the New Jersey Turnpike, which is a horrendous road if you've ever been on it. And, what Dr. Gagné is hoping to do is to take these sort of models, these organismal models, and apply them to other fields. So what can we learn about criminal behavior, or what can we learn about traffic systems? How can we design these systems better so that we can actually, you know, achieve the same efficiency as some of these other creatures.
So we can learn a lot from ants and slime mold. I never knew. Luke Groskin is Science Friday's video producer. Check out this macroscope video, The Road Best Traveled, at sciencefriday.com. Thanks so much, Luke.
Thank you.
One last thing before we go. A few weeks ago, we told you about astronomical confusion over a distant star with the friendly name of KIC 8462852. Astronomers using the Kepler telescope found that the light signal from that star dipped and dimmed a lot as they observed it, in ways that suggested something complicated was periodically moving between the star and our telescopes, something like a swarm of comets or maybe an alien structure. Well, the SETI Institute has trained its Allen telescope array on this star for more than 2 weeks, looking for two different kinds of radio signals. And there's been silence. So far, the SETI Institute scientists say no evidence of deliberately produced radio signals has been found in the direction of KIC 8462852. So we may have to look elsewhere for new friends. Oh well, at least there's a new Star Wars movie coming out. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls right here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And you can get a message from here to there. Join us in our Science Club message challenge. Go to sciencefriday.com/scienceclub to learn more and send us some of your machines. And by the way, no smartphones are allowed. If you'd like to write us, you can always send us letters. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. And you can email us, too. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.